Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Addisk, will be joining you for the second and third segment of the program today, and of course, he will be with James Corbett of the Corbett Report. But first, let's get to the market reports for Thursday, January 21st, 2016. Once again, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I was a little distracted there for a moment. I was looking at this one report that just came in, and let's get started right away. Gold had a little bit of a, it maintained above the 1100 mark today, but holding at that 1102 level for the day. We had a low of 1091 and a high of 1105. So hovering above 1100 is a good thing. Silver, a little bit of pressure, 0.02 to the downside, 1424. Platinum is holding at 823. Palladium had a little bit of a bump by four points at 502 for palladium. You have the USDX today, a little bit of pressure on the dollar, 0.13 at 98.98. Crude oil, of course, it came back after the big drop yesterday, 1.46, 29.81, still below that 30 level. Paper markets today, there was they were down in early market trading. They reversed themselves. They were up triple digits most of the day. 15,882. The NASDAQ, 4,472. The S&P, 1868, little changes between the NASDAQ and the S&P. Foreign markets, you had more pressure on Japan and Hong Kong. I believe the Shanghai was down, thought I saw 3%. I'll try and pull that up here while I'm talking. And London and Germany were both up close to 2%, so not a lot of change there. Let's see if I can find the Shanghai. Again, I'm on this new screen here, so everything is, placed a little bit differently. Yes, the Shanghai composite was down 3%, down 96 points at 28.80. The 10-year yield, that popped today back over to 2.02%. The euro, 109, still holding at that 109. It was down just a fraction of a point. And I think everyone was sort of holding their breath. Let's see if I can pull up this report, Mario Draghi. He didn't he let investors know that he's ready, that the European Central Bank is ready to take any type of action. Their next meeting is in March if this plunging oil price and this market turmoil by any means threatens their economy. And he did underline the his willingness to expand existing stimulus. And he said several times, he says there's no limit. He says he will do whatever it might take to apply any amount of stimulus to keep their economy continuing. They left key rates, interest rates unchanged, and they didn't ramp up any existing stimulus, but he did tell the markets that there's no limit of what he would do. So, you know, keep on doing what you're doing. Keep on setting yourself up for a bigger and bigger collapse. Already they have spent 1.5 trillion euros, which equals to about 1.63 trillion U.S. dollars. So, again, they have another meeting on March 10th. And, you know, they have the same interest level rate, 2%. I mean, they're pretty much copying what the Federal Reserve did here in the States. You know, Bernanke always said he would be very accommodative to the markets. But Draghi goes, I think he goes one step further and says, hey, no limit what we can do here. And again, we know the stimulus really only helps the corporations. It helps the banks. It doesn't help you and me. It doesn't help Main Street. It doesn't help. It might help create a few jobs, but the economies are not going back to once they once were. You know, they're slashing the returns on savings. So, you know, for your bank accounts, you know, you're getting less. People that are in retirement, they're getting less and less when they're living on a, you know, on a very small income. So that came out of England today. You know, I think everybody is focused on this big snowstorm. You know what? Here we have another storm of the century. Certainly now they'll be able to, you know, perhaps have another excuse for, you know, what happens for the first quarter this year. But already I think the numbers are dropping prior to the storm. So again, DC is supposed to get up to 3 feet of snow. And it's going to be one of the worst winter storms in Washington's history. Heck, they had a little bit of a flurries overnight. They've had hundreds of car accidents. So, you know, I don't get it, you know, but hey, you know, stay home, folks. If you can't drive and if you can't drive in snow flurries, you know, just stay home. You know, just stay home. I'm sure the government will pay you if you're employed by the government. You know, they're not gonna, you know, take your wages away. Just stay home. But anyway, I think there's a lot of focus on that. And again, you know, you're seeing all your grocery stores. You know, I don't get why people go to the grocery store when there's a snowstorm coming. I mean, if people don't have more than a week's supply of, if they only have a day's supply of food in their homes and they have to run to the grocery store and the grocery store only holds 3 days worth of inventory at any grocery store, you know, I mean, it just doesn't, you know, just doesn't play well for any type of major situation. News report out today, the number of Americans applying for unemployment benefits in mid-January reached 7-month highs. You know, you're going to see layoffs in the U.S. Rise. Again, you have all these oil jobs, you know, from the oil industry, from the oil prices dropping, you know, certainly a lot of layoffs there. So 293,000 from January 10th to January 16th, and this is the highest level since last July. Initial claims have risen more than 14%, after touching a post-recession low of 256,000 in early July. And there was a lot of, you know, I follow the daily layoffs that are announced. You know, and I usually don't bring them to the program because, you know, you have, you know, one company that might be laying off, you know, 10 or 12, and, you know, it's not. But it was an unusually heavy day in the layoffs today. Southwestern Energy, they're laying off 1,100. Pearson International, they're laying off 4,000. Barclays, even though this is jobs worldwide, they're laying off 1,000. You have Devon Energy, they didn't give a number. Nephron Pharmaceuticals, FanDuel, East Baton Rouge, Paris Clerc, they're just laying off a few. Here's one, United States Steel Corporation, 679. We have Southwestern Energy, they're looking to cut, I did mention them. Canadian Pacific Railway, they also have jobs in the States. They plan to cut close to 1,000 positions this year. We're going to talk about another story in Canada right here shortly, and it's sort of we'll talk about it in just a few minutes. There's a good news and bad news story. Walmart, they're looking to give nearly all of its U.S. hourly store employees, and it's just not the minimum wage earners, they're going to give everyone a raise as they employ over 1 million people. It's the largest private employer in the country, and they plan to boost its minimum wage in February to $10 an hour. But they also said that hourly workers employed in the stores would also get a 2% pay bump. The wage increase will affect nearly 1.2 million U.S. employees at the companies Walmart and Sam's Club. We know Walmart is trying to improve on their 4,600 U.S. stores. They're also trying to boost e-sales, emails, internet sales. So they're trying to also boost, so equals to about 2%. Now, that's the good news for those people who work at Walmart. Now, the bad news, well, does anyone remember just a week ago, 154 Walmart stores are closing in the U.S. and another 115 globally? So these people that are getting their wages are getting their wage increases from people who have just been laid off. So, you know, people, and it's amazing, the Walmart family is one of the richest families in the world. They're going to stay that way, and there isn't any way that they wouldn't give anyone a raise, even a lousy 2% raise, if it doesn't come from somebody else's pocket. It certainly isn't going to be from theirs. And of course, you know, some people might say, well, it's just good business. And it's like, well, you know, how much is good business? I mean, come on. You know, they're the richest, one of the richest families in the world, and a lousy 2%. You know, let's take it off the top of the profits that they make instead of laying off a whole bunch of people, you know. So bittersweet, but anyway, does it make any difference to the economy? Probably not. And, you know, they'll just fire a lot of people. They'll fire more people, or they'll, you know, slap them back to a part-time job. So instead of getting a 2% raise, they'll get a, you know, $10 an hour. We talked about Mario Draghi. Again, it was kind of a weird, quiet day in the markets. So, you know, there was one report I wanted to bring to you, and we talked about the housing markets in Texas and how some of the North Dakotas, the home prices are beginning to drop. They've been overvalued, and this is all relates to, you know, the oil industry and so forth. But, you know, when we talk about, or when mainstream media, we don't talk about it because I don't see an expansion in the economy. But let's use their terms. 6 years after the economic expansion began, only 93% of counties in the U.S. have failed to fully recover. 93% have failed to fully recover. So again, how can you have an economic expansion when only 93% of the counties have failed to fully recover? That means only 7% of the counties in the United States have recovered. And again, those are all attached. Many of them are attached to the oil industry. Nationwide, 214 counties, or 7% of 3,000, had recovered last year to pre-recession levels on four indicators. 7%. Total employment, unemployment rate, size of the economy, and home values, all of this equaled the four indicators. And this study was released, was released by the National Association of Counties. Slowing the industry shifts means that some parts of the country will likely never fully recover. But by the end of last year, more counties had not recovered on any one of the four indicators. 16% of them recovered on all of them. So again, this economy is not what they tell us to be. It is an illusion, and it will continue to be an illusion until we begin to look at it and adjust and do something. And of course, I think we're too far gone in order to continue any type of turnaround in this country. Anyway, let's talk. This is something that I've been affected by personally. And it really doesn't have a lot to do with the economy. I'm bringing this information to you because I was told I was the only one that refused to accept the smart meter by the power company. I came home one day from an errand, found a power truck in my driveway, and they were there to put in the smart meter. I rejected it. They wanted me to sign something. I didn't, but then I got one in the mail that I had to sign because I was rejecting it. And maybe I was not the only one, but I was told I was the only one. Because I rejected the smart meter, I am being billed for $75 up front, and they will bill me on my electrical bill $17 a month thereafter. And that is the cost for them to read my meter. Even though they only read it four times a year, the other two times they're estimated, but they're going to charge me $17 a month thereafter. And it was interesting, today I received an article from a friend, and he calls in Dave from Michigan. And this article was last week in Ontario. Hydro One finally admitted the rural smart meters do not work, and they have decided to pull the plug on 36,000 of them to start. BC Hydro, they just announced plans to remove 88,000 meters suspected of failure. Now, costing ratepayers billions, smart meters are actually designed to unlawfully harvest detailed data of the in-home activities of occupants without their knowledge or consent. Hydro One, now they're not planning to uninstall smart meters and replace it with analogs, but rather to manually read the customer's meters quarterly. And again, like what they do here, and estimate the months in between, because the wireless reporting is simply not working. More than 10,000 billing complaints have been filed with the Ontario and the Auditor General of Ontario released a scathing report calling out the smart meter program as a total flop. Hydro One was the first major utility in Canada to deploy the so-called smart meters upon an unsuspecting customer base. Now, this price tag for them was $2 billion, and of course, everything's always over budget. It was over $900 million over budget. So these smart utility meters are being deployed worldwide under the banner of climate action. But what they do is they typically increase energy usage, and a high-level industry executive has admitted that the data that is collected by these devices will be worth a lot more than the electricity itself. So I know many of you listeners have already rejected your smart meters, but you know, I was affected by this. I'm being charged. I'm being penalized because I rejected this meter, and this meter doesn't work anyway. And there's even reports about how this also can have an effect on your health. So I thought it was important to bring this up. You know, it's not a topic that we normally talk about on this program, but it is important. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Give us a call here at Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Make sure you sign up for our weekly newsletter. I'm going to have this article in the newsletter this week. Get to the website, dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com, and make sure you sign up for it. Alfred and James will be with you in just a few minutes.
Have a heart condition and emergency rooms and medical doctors are not an option, you need our emergency heart attack kit. 5 concentrated liquid formulas enter the system in 60 seconds to protect your heart muscle, strengthen heartbeat, increase circulation, relieve pain, and make breathing easier. When seconds count, you want all the help you can get with our emergency heart attack kit. Easy to use and portable in a 1-pound compact kit for your purse, briefcase, or car. Call Apothecary Herbs now for your emergency heart attack kit toll-free. 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
I'm Alfred Addis, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Our guest is James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. James is acquiring more and more recognition, not just in the United States, but around the world. And it's gaining traction as someone that we should be paying attention to. Someone who does a great deal of thinking, sees the big picture, and is often able to illuminate interesting ideas, concepts for those of us who are perhaps less intellectually endowed. Hello, James. How are you doing?
Can you? Hello. Am I on? Here we are.
Yeah, you're on. Yeah, you are.
I'm trying to work my mute button here, so I don't know if I can live up to the hype. But I don't know. I feel a bit nervous about the Illuminate word. It sounds like I'm part of some sort of secret society.
Yeah, you probably are. It's called intelligent people. It's not necessarily the Illuminated or the Illuminati, but it may be people who are capable of illuminating, you know, explaining ideas and helping people understand what's going on. I've got an article from Fortune magazine. The headline is Analyst. Here comes the biggest stock market crash in the generation. And they're talking about a man named Albert Edwards, strategist at Société Générale. Was much to say. He hasn't had much to say that's positive about the global economy in years. He's recently predicted a disaster. U.S. stock market's plunging as much as 75%. And he argues that since the 2008 financial crisis, the global economy has been dependent on the Federal Reserve's massive bond buying program to prop up equity prices and stimulate growth in emerging markets. In other words, the Federal Reserve's quantitative easing program and zero interest rate policies, they haven't merely been designed to support the U.S. economy, or at least that was the expressed intention, but they've actually had a massive effect on the global economy, and they have been supporting the global economy. Do you think that's a reasonable argument?
Yes. I think the supporting the global economy is more of a byproduct of what's been going on than the goal of what's been going on. But it certainly has had that effect, at least in terms of getting some of that hot QE funny money off of the printing presses and out of the country and into emerging markets. And to whatever extent the emerging markets have put that to productive use, that may be a byproduct of what's happening. But really, it's just the logical conclusion of what's been happening with the QE madness, because, of course, if all of the returns on any particular investment is falling down to minuscule levels and you can't get any good returns domestically, well, where are you going to take that money? You're going to go put it somewhere where there's a bubble growing. And in the last several years, that bubble has been in the emerging markets. So I think it's really just a question of investors looking for the best place to put their funny money.
Okay, you don't think this was an intention, this was not an intended consequence, but it's happened. Once they stopped QE, quantitative easing, and they stopped pumping more money into the, openly pumping more money into the U.S. economy, it would follow that that's fundamental cause for collapse of emerging markets. And when they step back from zero interest rate policy, they've only raised the interest rate by 0.25%. Again, it's evidence that they have decided to stop supporting the U.S. and or global economies. And we've seen, is that a primary feature, even a primary cause for the decline in the global economy?
Well, again, I think it's just the logic of the situation. We're just reversing what's happened over the last several years, or they're trying to reverse what's happened over the last several years by taking the training wheels off. And, of course, what is happening is it's just unwinding the whole deal. So, of course, all of that money that flooded out into the emerging economies is flooding back into the country, and all of the ramifications of that are playing out now. And it's really just a question of whether they're going to continue sticking to their guns and continue raising rates, as has been the plan, which seems almost unimaginable at this particular moment with stock markets crashing to record levels. I mean, this is the worst start to the year since the Great Depression in U.S. markets. I can't imagine they're going to continue with their rate hikes. And in fact, we're getting more analysts, not just the Peter Schiffs and contrarians of the world, but more mainstream analysts coming out and saying that a QE4 is going to be the eventual result of this.
I've seen reports that the balance sheet for the Federal Reserve is only 0.3% positive. And as I understand it, that means they weigh their assets against their liabilities. And on that balance sheet, they're only 0.3% more assets than they have liabilities. That makes me wonder, do they have the resources to implement another round of quantitative easing? And if the price of bonds falls significantly, will it wipe out the 0.3% positive on their balance sheet. And if that happens, is the Federal Reserve technically bankrupt?
Well, yes, but I don't think there's anything that technically stops them from going into that insolvency region. Again, they just continue doing it. And if they fall to the point where their assets are less than their liabilities, there's nothing that physically stops them from doing that. So, yes, I think that is the ultimate outcome of where this is heading, but I don't think they actually particularly care. I mean, whether it's 30% or 0.3% or zero, negative 0.3% or negative 30%, it's still a question of whether or not they have the if not the faith, at least the goodwill of the rest of the world to continue trading in U.S. dollars.
Well, there's the point. I mean, I understand that they can physically make paper dollars and particularly digital dollars just appear out of thin air. I get that. But at what point in time do they exceed the full faith and capacity for self-delusion of the American people? We're told time and again that the monetary system is based on our faith and confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And at what point, you know, you have to wonder, if they lose that, then what?
The way I look at that calculation, I mean, it is a calculation that people are making, whether they are consciously aware of it or not, but I think it's a pretty easy calculation to be made at this particular point, because the question has to be not just, you know, how reliable is the U.S. dollar, but what are the alternatives? And unless and until there is a viable alternative to replace that place, the place that U.S. dollar has in global trade, let alone American trade, until there is a real viable alternative there, I don't think the vast majority of the public are going to abandon it. And of course, the alternatives do exist. I mean, whether that's precious metals or cryptocurrencies or whatever people are into, there are alternative models. It's just that no one really takes them, or the vast majority of people don't take them seriously as a sort of day-to-day, you know, what they would transact with in their everyday lives. So until that point at which there is that viable alternative, or something that is seen as a viable alternative to the public, they can continue doing what they want with the currency, unfortunately.
Do you see anything that might be a viable alternative? Do you see anything, any alternative at all, that might even be a compelled alternative? Is there anything on the horizon, or is a dollar here and essentially get used to it?
Do you want me to talk about aspirationally or what I actually see developing? Because those are two different things.
About both of them?
Well, okay. I mean, I would like to see people starting to use not just one or two or three different ways of transacting, but many, many. And, you know, that's going to play out differently depending on who you're transacting with and where and under what situation. But the idea that we all have to use the same asset, the same commodity, the same currency in all of our transactions with everyone in every way is, I think, an outdated way of thinking about this. So I'd like to see people using precious metals and cryptocurrencies and community currencies and whatever else the market could come up with, if there was a free market in currencies. That's what I'd like to see. What I actually see as the counter-narrative that's taking place, that's taking shape right now, is along the lines of what we talked about before with regards to some sort of internationalization through something like a special drawing rights of the IMF. Again, I see the basket of currency idea being something that is being built up right now to be the replacement for that U.S. dollar reserve.
Well, the idea of multiple currencies, and in a sense it's there. If I wanted to buy something from China one way or another, if I wanted to pay for it with, I don't know, Swedish kroners, I'm sure there's a way to make it happen. But doesn't that complicate things? In a way, multiple currencies, if I'm going to do business with another country and I'm going to do it in an Bitcoin, what happens if Bitcoin all of a sudden falls? I'm going to get wiped out. It's not just a question. In order to be in business, or at least in order to be in global business, I don't just have to build a better mousetrap. I have to calculate which one of the currencies I want to do business in any particular time where I have the maximum opportunity of generating a profit and not being wiped out by some change in the currency fluctuations. It's hard to imagine how multiple currencies are going to, you know, does that really work, or do we have to have one? In the end, it's there can be only one. Is that the essence of currency wars?
Well, if you're looking to measure value, you would have to measure it against something stable. But we are in a system where all of the currencies that are officially recognized are measured against each other. I mean, there's no other way to do it in the system that we're in. So whether we like it or not, we're in a system where currencies are measured against each other. And so you have things like the U.S. dollar index, which, of course, just takes all of the various different currencies that the U.S. dollar trades against and tries to measure, you know, whether the dollar is trending upwards or downwards, whether it's getting stronger or weaker. But still, I mean, it's ultimately a system where there is no such thing as that timeless, immutable yardstick that you can use as the measure for the value of a dollar or whatever. It's all relative to each other, which is part of the whole trick of the thing, because, of course, as we've seen over the past century of the Federal Reserve's existence, you can devalue the currency by 97%, and most people won't even really understand or recognize what's happening there. They'll just know that if you're saving for the long term, you don't save in dollars and put them in the bank account because they're not going to be worth the same when they get out. People understand that much, but they don't quite understand why that's happening. So, I'm not sure what the question is specifically, but the way the system has been engineered, there is no way to measure these against one immutable value. So it's all going to be just a question of comparing what to what. And the basket idea, the basket idea is supposed to be appealing because instead of everyone trying to measure something against the dollar, which itself has no intrinsic value, well, why don't you take a few different things with no intrinsic value, but at least they're spread out. They're spread out geographically. They're spread out in terms of different economies. They're underlain by different productive economic activity themselves. So that balances each other out so that if one major collapse happens, it's not going to completely, you know, dismantle the entire world system.
Well, it's, you know, we've got the dollar sitting on one end of the teeter-totter on the U.S. dollar index, and half a dozen other currencies sitting on the other end of the teeter-totter. And if the dollar goes down, then everything else goes down at the same time. But the other point is this. The dollar has no intrinsic value, and the currencies that it's being measured against have no intrinsic value. Does this create an illusion of value? Is the U.S. dollar index actually here to tell us that the dollar's value is growing today and it's falling tomorrow? Or is it here to create an illusion that the U.S. dollar, the fiat dollar, has any value in the first place? You understand what I'm saying?
I do.
Is it intended to deceive or is it intended to inform?
Well, I think it does both for different audiences at the same time. And I think, I think the real audience that understands and appreciates the information that is being conveyed by something like the U.S. dollar index are people who are involved in international foreign currency exchange as part of, you know, whatever transactions they do on a daily basis, which is a vanishingly small sliver of the population, obviously. For the rest of the population who doesn't really need that information in that sense, I mean, it's helpful to know whether the U.S. dollar is going up or down in the sense that it will ultimately translate into cheaper or more expensive goods in the store, but that's a very difficult thing for most people to wrap their heads around, and it's hard to show people how that's affecting their daily lives and bottom line. So it really is just kind of a psychological bellwether for people. Oh, look, the dollar's getting stronger, yay. Or, oh, the dollar's getting weaker, we better do something. And I think it's used as that kind of, you know, just a red flag for a bull, basically, to try to steer the population into whatever economic measures, whatever government is in power wants to do.
The price of oil, of course, is maybe the foremost subject in the media, at least in the last week or two. It's fallen 25% in just the first 2 weeks of this year. How low will oil go?
Well, let's ask the Royal Bank of Scotland, which you might have seen just came out with this really quite bleak warning for the new year, literally saying it was going to be a cataclysmic year. That's the quote, yeah. And telling investors to sell everything. Mm-hmm. And they believe that the oil could slump to as low as $16 a barrel. I don't know if it's going to go that low, but I think it does have further to go down. And I certainly don't see it picking back up with any steam until likely in the 2018 region. I couldn't imagine it could be any further sooner than that, because there is already baked into the cake a lot of overproduction. Plus, now we have Iran coming back online with 1 million plus barrels a day. I just think there's a glut, and I don't think it's going to be solved in the next year or two. And that's not good for oil price in the sense, you know, if people want the oil price to go up, that's not good.
They almost, you know, we're going to take a break here in just the next 20 or 30 seconds. When we come back, we'll talk about this oil glut and the falling price of gasoline, for example, and the falling prices of energy. We'll start the next segment with this question. Is the falling price of crude oil, is it on balance? Does it stimulate the economy with lower energy prices, or does it tend to slow the economy and push us into depression because it's contributing to deflation? And that'll be our question when we begin in just a moment. We're going to take a break. I'm Alfred Addis here with James Corbett on Financial Survival. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Count high. Half of all men over 50 have an enlarged prostate. You can shrink your prostate without harmful drugs or risky surgery. The secret to healing the prostate is to cleanse the prostate and the liver. Call Apothecary Herbs to ask about the Prostate Kit for a comprehensive way to heal and soothe your prostate. Educate yourself on how easy it can be to disinfect, cleanse, and restore your prostate gland. Call Apothecary Herbs for the Prostate Kit and successfully reduce swelling, inflammation, dissolve stones, and cleanse the blood to obtain the results you need. Money-back guarantee with every purchase. Call the experts in organ cleansing. Call Apothecary Herbs now for the Prostate Kit and empower yourself. Toll free 866-229-3663 for international callers 704-875-8010. That's toll free 866-229-3663 or visit the web at thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97%. Of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival. Our guest is James Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, from thecorbettreport.com. When we left, said that we were going to ask, on balance, is the falling price of crude oil contributing to deflation and global economic depression, or is the falling price of crude oil actually likely to stimulate the global economy with cheaper oil and energy prices? On balance. The answer is both, I suppose, but on balance, which do you think is predominant?
Yeah, well, it is a question of balance, and there's no doubt that a certain lowering of oil prices will tend to boost economic activity, as it makes basically the cost of everything that you can imagine doing in the economy cheaper because of the underlying economic principle of the oil that underlies so many of the processes. But it is, as you say, a balance, and if you've got if it's down too much, then it actually starts to hinder markets generally, and it does cause the commodity deflation, or at least precipitate the commodity deflation that we are seeing going on. I think whatever that balance may be, given And again, this is proscriptive. This is not my ideal economy, but given the type of very much petrochemical dependent economy we're in, it has reached the point where it is a drag now on global commodity prices generally. So this is having a depressed effect. And I guess, one layer of nuance we could add to it is to say that there is no such thing as the economy. I mean, what economy are you talking about and affecting whom? I mean, any falling market is a good market for someone who's positioned in the right way in the right place. But it's bad news for a lot of people. And of course, I'm from Alberta in Canada, the Texas of the North. So I know there's an awful lot of economic pain going on there right now. And so there's definitely a downside to this for millions upon millions of people whose lives, for better or worse, have been tied into the oil industry.
I've heard that the cost of Canadian bitumen, heavy sands, heavy tar sands per barrel up in Canada have reached a point where they are about a tenth of the cost of the barrel itself. If you get a barrel, you can buy a barrel for $50. And I mean, the barrel, the physical metal barrel, you can buy the tar sand, the heavy crude. It's actually selling for about a seventh or a tenth of the price of the barrel, which is, it's just irrational. I mean, it's like buying a hamburger at McDonald's where the, and this may be happening already. I hadn't thought about it till now, but maybe the box and the wrapper are worth more than the hamburger itself.
Probably has more nutritional value.
Yeah, it might be. It may have.
Yeah. No, I hear what you're saying. And there's no doubt that this, what's happening right now, completely changes the calculation for all sorts of operations, shale and fracking and tar sands and all of that. And that's why, I mean, I think by 2018, we will definitely start to see the contraction that's taking place right now having played out. But it's not the kind of thing you just flip a switch. There's still a lot of excess supply baked into the cake for at least a couple of years.
When you say this contraction playing out by 2018, what do you mean by playing out? Do you mean there'll be peace in the valley and the price is going back up to $100 a barrel? Or do you mean that a bunch of companies and perhaps even nations will have been driven into bankruptcy by cheap oil prices and taken off the table as suppliers?
I think that's exactly what we see happening right now. And as I say, I think that will continue to happen over the next couple of years until there is something more like an equilibrium reached. And of course, this is, again, all contingent on whatever happens, you know, between then and now geopolitically, and whatever kind of, you know, Middle East shenanigans happen or those types of supply disruptions. But again, all things being equal, this is starting to cause a lot of layoffs and a lot of contraction in terms of new exploration and things like that. But again, that will take a couple of years before that really starts to affect what's happened, what's flooding into the market every day now.
Talking about the Middle East, Saudi Arabia is credited with precipitating the current decline in the price of crude oil. They made up their mind they were going to keep pumping or pumping more, even though prices were falling, and they've got something started which seems to have gone out of control, and everyone who is an oil producer is being hurt by this. I see three ways to solve the oil glut. And one, the first one is an agreement to limit production. The second one is corporate and national bankruptcies that take some of the producers offline. And the third way is war, to actually destroy oil-producing capacity from one nation or another. There's an article in oilprice.com that talks, and the headline is, "War between Saudi Arabia and Iran could send oil prices to $250 a barrel." Now, I find that number unreasonable, but what do you think the prospect is of war between Saudi Arabia and Iran?
Sadly, it's a lot higher than it was even a year ago. There is absolutely a narrative that's playing out right now, and to what extent it represents a true changing of the tide and to what extent it may be played up by certain interests that would benefit from seeing oil prices go up at the moment. I mean, we have to keep those types of things in mind, but there is something happening right now that represents at least an acceleration of a trend and an increase in tensions between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And Yemen would obviously be one of the key examples of this, where you have the militia, whatever you want to call them, that's taken over the capital, being supposedly supported by Iran. I think some of that is overplayed, but at any rate, there's some sort of affinity there between the Houthis and Iran, and Saudi Arabia trying to bomb them off the map. It is a proxy war of some sort, and it's interesting to see China, China's president Xi Jinping, is now on a little Middle Eastern North African tour, a very interesting little tour he's making to Saudi Arabia and Iran and Egypt, and he's just pledged support for the Yemen government against these Iranian-backed militias. So it looks like China and Saudi Arabia getting closer and closer together in, into bed, which may shift that balance, because as we've talked about before here in on this program, Saudi Arabia is edging out from the U.S. military umbrella and getting cozier and cozier with China. And this is just another expression of that. So if Saudi Arabia is emboldened enough by being under the U.S. military umbrella and having Chinese support, who knows? I've certainly seen Iran coming back into the crosshairs in a big way in the mainstream media in the United States. And maybe we are being prepared for some sort of conflict. I think that's a very, I think it would not be a good situation for humanity, but I think we're being positioned to at least expect that.
Do you think the Saudi Arabians are edging out from under the U.S. umbrella of protection, or is the U.S. withdrawing that umbrella? Are the Saudis leaving us, or are we leaving them?
It's an interesting question. I tend to look at it as the Saudis, well, I think they'd like to have their cake and eat it too. I'm sure they'd love to
be
cozy to the U.S. and China, but I think they realize that cozying up to China can only happen by edging out from that umbrella. So I think it's a move on Saudi Arabia's part. That's the way I read it, because Saudi Arabia knows what side their bread is buttered on. It is an oil kingdom, and the big oil purchaser in this day and age is China, and the growing one. And one that's, I mean, again, China may be slowing down, but their population is still gigantic, and their general economic level is still rising. So they're going to require more and more oil. So I think Saudi Arabia sees that in the long term, China is going to be the trading partner. And I think they're just edging out that way. So I've always considered it in that way. I don't see why the U.S. would be pushing Saudi Arabia away at this point.
They're certainly perceived to do that insofar as the United States has tried to reach accommodations with Iran. They are perceived to have done that with the treaty that they've reached that supposedly restricts Iran's ability to make nuclear devices. And insofar as Iran agrees with that, they are no longer under economic sanctions. Saudi Arabia has been really upset about that. Saudi Arabia has been allegedly talking to Israel. They have more in common with Israel than they do with the Muslims. The Muslim nation of Saudi Arabia may have more in common with the Jewish nation of Israel than it does with the Muslim nation of Iran. They talk about politics making for strange bedfellows, but I guarantee you there's nothing as strange as the bedfellows you can find in commerce. All about the money. I'm looking at this and I'm thinking to myself, Saudi Arabia is not well liked, in my opinion. They don't have a positive image. They throw great parties and they got a lot of money to throw around and rest, that sort of thing, but they inspire people's contempt because they are spectacularly wealthy and they are, you know, they exploit their wealth in ways that are offensive to people who are poor, even Muslims, fellow Muslims or not. And the point I'm getting to, is Saudi Arabia a natural target? Are they despised almost as much as Israel by the global community? And if so, are they a natural target for war?
That's an interesting question. I would say they are not despised by the global community, if we mean the globalists. They are self-evidently courted by them. And I think we've all seen those famous pictures of, you know, the Bushes literally holding hands with various members of the Saudi royal family and that sort of image. I think it's interesting to think about if the outrage machine of the U.S. propaganda MSM mainstream media propaganda mill really turned its outrage attention towards Saudi Arabia. I think the American public could become very quickly very interested in seeing the Saudi royal family deposed because, I mean, you have a large percentage of the American population at this point hates the Assad government in Syria, but probably couldn't tell you anything about it or why they hate it. It's just, oh, it's, you know, a crazy guy in the Middle East.
You gotta hate somebody.
You gotta hate somebody.
They're handy. Yeah,
but,
we gotta have
some. But I mean, think about all of the things that Saudi Arabia, I mean, it's just a matter of course in the repressive Saudi Arabia, the beheadings, the public executions, the, you know, women can't drive a car or be, you know, alone in the presence of other men, things of that nature, which could very easily provoke a lot of outrage if the media spotlight was turned to it. And I think we have seen a little bit of flirtation in recent years, a little bit more room for criticism of Saudi Arabia, even in the propaganda mainstream media. And I think that's a bit of a threat on the U.S. side. I think they're trying to provide a bit of course, they have the carrot, but they have a bit of stick up their sleeve in case Saudi Arabia tries to get a little too cozy with China.
All right. I've got what's happening in Japan right now? We've got about 2.5-3 minutes left. Maybe even four minutes left. What's happening to the Japanese economy? China is allegedly coming to a near stop. Where's Japan's economy right now? Strong, faltering? Is it threatened where people are really concerned?
It is faltering on every level now. It's been faltering this entire time, but for the last couple of years, at the very least, you could point to the Nikkei stock index and go, oh, look, it's hitting these extremely high levels. Yay. But even that has faltered in recent weeks, and especially in the last couple of days where the Japanese stock market officially entered bear territory, down 20% from its highs, I believe, last summer. So of course, here, politically, we have Shinzo Abe, who came to power largely on the back of his promise to fix the economy and to get things started again with his Abenomics. Well, that, as I say, that did have the effect, at least in the stock market, of a little bit of a boost by devaluing the yen. That has not translated into increases in real wages here. It has not stimulated any serious economic productivity. And now it's being exposed as, you know, the emperor wearing no clothes, because even the stock market gains are being lost. So it's not a pretty situation. There's no bright news on the Japanese economic horizon. The central bank doesn't have much more tricks up its sleeve other than further devaluing the yen. That's pretty much the only thing they have at this point. And on top of all of that, of course, is the underlying problem of the demographic problem here with the aging population. So it's lose, 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 and there's really a lot of, I mean, it's quiet despair. One of the strangest things about this is that it kind of seems to be having the opposite of effect as you would assume. In 2015, I've seen the latest stats, suicides, which of course are famously high in Japan, actually decreased, and violent crime or crime of any sort has actually decreased significantly since its high, which was hit, I think, in 2002. Reported crimes are down significantly since that point. So I'm not sure exactly why the social trends seem to be going in the opposite way, but certainly economically speaking, no one is really, you know, celebrating what's happening here.
We don't have enough time to really answer the next question, but is it possible that the Japanese people have simply become so moral that they're not going to respond to the phony, baloney stimulus that the Japanese banks, central bank, and government are putting out? Have they just said, look, I'm not buying anymore. I don't care what happens. I'm not going to participate in robbing other people, because that's what quantitative easing and zero interest rate policies ultimately do. They're robbing some. They're robbing Peter to pay Paul. Have the Japanese people become more moral, and they just said, I can't deal with it. Don't want part of it. Don't want to be a complicit.
I would love to believe that. I don't believe that, though. No, I would say they've become demoralized, i.e., they, after 20 years of stagnation, they don't expect anything's going to come and save them at this point. And, well, it seems to be playing out that way. It's not going to come and save them. And so there's just a sort of gloom over the economy, which, of course, puts a hamper on consumer spending and on investment.
All right, James, we're going to have to let it go at that. Thanks very much for being on the program. Always enjoy talking to you. Hope we will talk to you again next week. Thank you, folks, for listening. I'm Alfred Addisk, and we will be back. I'll be back tomorrow with Melody Cedarstrom. And in the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank, the producer, and James Corbett. Good night.
I work on all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? Still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.